Our rates have come down, but there are still 300 and something people in hospital with Omicron on any given day. We know about long COVID being a problem afterwards, even if the actual illness has been mild sometimes. We've heard about the brain fog and lingering fatigue. But there's something else being closely studied. A high-powered collaboration between Cambridge University and Imperial College in the UK has resulted in a rigorous examination of the long-term cognitive effects of COVID. It's said to be the first time this has been so thoroughly done. Joining us is the study's senior author, neuroscientist Professor David Menin. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Yours is a pretty thorough study. The cases in it would mainly have had Delta?
Yes, pretty much all of them, as far as we know, yeah.
Okay. How might this skew the results? Or if you've become quite ill, it doesn't really matter which strain you've had?
I think the answer to both of those is yes. Particularly the most recent wave has not resulted in as much severe illness. Now, we think that a large proportion of the cause of this neurological deterioration is due to the host response, what the body is doing in response to the infection. Consequently, the fact that more recent waves of the virus have not resulted in as severe illness make it likely that we're not going to see as much cognitive dysfunction. Maybe because of vaccination, because a large proportion of the UK population are now vaccinated. It may be because we're using drugs that damped out inflammation a lot more. It's a complex situation because many things have happened at the same time.
Were they mostly older people, David?
No, the median age was around in the early 50s, so it was a range, and some of them were under 50 as well, so not all older people.
It's a fairly grim headline given the study in one of the science journals, Cognitive Impact of Severe COVID is Equivalent to 20 Years of Aging, but it is accurate.
What's special about our study, because there have been bigger studies, other people have reported cognitive dysfunction after COVID, severe COVID, and also after mild COVID in the context of what's being called long COVID. I think what made us slightly different is the fact that we had this huge population of healthy controls, which were collected as part of a citizen science initiative run by Adam Hampshire, the Great British Intelligence Test. If you ask whether it's a grim headline and whether it's accurate, what we know is the approximate magnitude of change in cognition that happens between 50 and 70. And in order to let people calibrate what kind of level of dysfunction happens after COVID, that was the comparator we used. I wouldn't claim that this was a precise estimate, but it does provide a yardstick of the sort of level of cognitive dysfunction we see.
As you say, cognitive impairment results from a number of neurological disorders and medical conditions. But what happens in the brain if you've been severely ill with COVID is different?
Possibly. It's important to make the point that patients who've had critical illness have cognitive dysfunction when assessed at 6 months, the sort of time frame that we were looking at, even if they haven't had COVID, just community-acquired pneumonia, peritonitis, common or garden sepsis, which brings patients into our intensive care units every day of every week. It's not different in type, but maybe slightly different in magnitude, because the host response caused by COVID may be a bit worse. Now, we have another paper which is currently under review, which looks at brain injury biomarkers, the sorts of biomarkers that come out in the bloodstream after patients have had a traumatic brain injury. And we demonstrated that in the acute phase, patients who were in the intensive care unit have elevation of these biomarkers. It's probably multifactorial, but it provides additional proof that there is an insult to the brain during acute severe COVID, which then has these late residual consequences.
We're talking with Professor David Menin. Verbal agility, finding words and so on, is the most affected brain area?
So it's the most affected cognitive domain. And it's probably because it's quite a complex task. We do this on the fly all the time. If I were to ask you, button is to buttonhole as shoelace is to, you'd say shoes, or or if I were to say gloves are to hands as socks are to, you'd say feet. But when you think about it, there are lots of cognitive processes happening. We've got to draw on our knowledge of what these things do and what how they all fit together. So it may not be that it's a single cognitive domain. It may be because it's drawing on so many cognitive domains, and the sick brain, or the brain that has been sick, is just struggling to do this on the fly as quickly as you and I can currently.
Understood. And there'll be people, some people at least, suffering these effects who stayed at home, who got through it without being admitted to hospital but were pretty ill.
By definition, if they managed not to require hospitalization, they must have had, on average at least, slightly less severe illness. It isn't that you would be free of any consequences. It's just that the processes involved and perhaps the specific consequences may be slightly different.
Yes, you found that although you might be fatigued and have mental problems, those sorts of symptoms aren't linked to a decline in cognition, basically.
No, that's right. And in some ways, that's quite important because if someone is really tired and absolutely exhausted, and everything that they do wrong cognitively just scales with that, it could be an explanation saying that this is just overall fatigue and it's not a specific cognitive dysfunction.
Statistically, there'll be a lot of people out there in countries all over the world trying to cope with a slower brain and without much help or understanding, often, we assume.
That is true. So we followed people up to 10 months, and within that time period, certainly there is slowing. But again, I come back to this. If you're slightly older and you've been in hospital and had a major operation, if you've been in hospital, even if you've not been in an intensive care unit when you come out, even if you have a bad attack of the flu, even if you get vaccinated, so there's good literature on typhoid vaccination and influenza vaccination. This inflammatory process that's triggered off does make the brain feel poorly. There is inevitably going to be recovery. There's no question about it. It's how complete the recovery is that's slightly in question now, and we will have to follow our patients up to see. So when you say that there are people all over the world who are dealing with this, that's true. But just like it's not a new finding for COVID, maybe slightly worse, we can identify it much more in detail because we've got this homogeneous population of patients. Other illnesses and even less severe illnesses, and as I said, even vaccination may cause cognitive problems, but they're brief and tend to resolve. And the hope is that even the cognitive function dysfunction that we've seen with COVID will over time improve. And that certainly is the anecdotal evidence that we're getting from talking to people, but we'll analyze the data and know for sure.
Yes, you observed degrees of recovery, but so it may be that if you're younger, the brain will have time to get back up to speed. If you're older, though, perhaps not, David.
So I think it depends on two or three things. The first thing is the severity of the insult. I think it depends on whether you had a very bad illness or a less severe illness. The second is your reserve. And if you're younger, your reserve is likely to be higher. Again, on average, people vary enormously. And we had someone who was over the age of 80 who had a very severe illness, some neurological complications as well, but made such a good recovery that they went back to a very productive and high-performing life. So there's a lot of individual variation. It's where these two meet each other. The severity of the insult has to meet the point at which your reserve has been transgressed. And once you drop below that floor, then you become symptomatic. Now, in conditions such as, say, traumatic brain injury, which I do quite a lot of work on, we know that what happens is that the normal cognitive decline that happens with age to all of us, you reach that threshold earlier than you would otherwise. So age-related cognitive decline is brought forward. So that's one possibility. But the final thing, the die is cast when we are born. We're given a hand of genes that we have to play through our life with. And there's a huge difference between people who have a gene set that means that they have a little more inflammation versus those that have a gene set that say that has a little less inflammation. Clearly, there's a sweet spot because if you don't have any inflammatory response, you can't fight the virus. But if you have too much, you're more likely to cause damage to your own organs. And it's a combination of those three that'll decide how you feel and how you function.
The mounting evidence that our own immune and inflammatory responses may be important, as you've just said, is this independent of health to an extent? Is this a lottery, or are we talking about people with medical predispositions that we can identify as high risk?
We know that people who have pre-existing cardiovascular disease and respiratory disease are more likely to have problems simply because their physiological reserve is less. But undeniably, there is the lottery of genetics, as you very nicely put it, that decides whether you get those diseases as well, because we know that the development of hypercholesterolemia, hypertension, diabetes are also quite strongly genetically linked. So it's not just your host response to COVID, but also your host response that allows you or not allows you to develop those other diseases. So there is a lottery, but just as with, say, developing coronary artery disease, behaviors can make a huge difference. So exercise, a good diet, can make you less likely to develop, or taking an anti-cholesterol medication, less likely to develop those consequences that we've talked about in terms of diabetes, stroke, and heart disease. And similarly, behaviors with COVID, making sure you get vaccinated, wearing a mask in the appropriate places, and so on, can modify the risk of getting COVID and also its severity. So it's both the lottery of genetics, but also what you do with the hand that you're dealt.
Yes, yes. But in the UK, according to the last official count, only 2.7% of the population, mercifully, had any form of long COVID. So most people's chances of avoiding it, especially in the severity that you've been talking about, most people's chances are pretty good.
Yes, and there's no uptick in the severity, in the severe cases, despite the fact that the society is opening up pretty substantially. And even if the viruses are as bad as Delta and they bring you to hospital, we now have medication that damps down that inflammatory response. So all of those things mean that going forward, we're less likely, this is an opinion, we don't have the data as yet, we're less likely to see these problems emerging. But if you get sick enough, regardless of whether it's COVID or not, and you get into an intensive care unit and you require drugs to keep your blood pressure up and you're in high levels of oxygen, and you have a huge host response that is associated with these severe illnesses, these risks are there, and we just have to find better ways to deal with them. Though this has been a terrible insult to society and to individuals who suffered from these consequences, hopefully we'll acquire more knowledge and be able to generalize that knowledge beyond COVID.
Just one more quick thing. We never expected this, I think, from COVID when it began. We still don't know, although you've linked it to those other brain insults most usefully, we still don't know how COVID, deep down, we don't know how COVID can quite smite people like this, why it also can have these effects. Is that right?
Yeah, but we have some pretty strong suspicions. It may be that the activation of clotting that COVID causes blockage of small vessels. It makes the blood vessels leaky. There may be a direct infection of the brain as well. That's certainly possible. And the whole class of viruses, the SARS coronaviruses, have a reputation. They have form in this regard of being able to infect neurological tissue, and trying to understand exactly what molecules are involved and how they interact with each other so that we can, having understood the process, try to intervene and make it less severe.
Yeah, that sounds like fascinating and encouraging work. David, thank you very much for your time with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Not at all. Thanks. Nice speaking to you, Jim.